when I looked at my path, when I looked at the expected path, because look, there's no shortage of people that will tell you who you should be and what you should live. And so I say, you cannot live an authentic life living someone else's life. You cannot live an authentic life being someone that you're not. And so when I looked at that path, the expected path, the path that everyone expected in terms of, you know, being normal, I just, it was a death for me. You know, I felt the pain of that death, and the death of my own soul's betraying itself, and that really shook me up. You know, that really, really shook me up. And so when I looked at my future, when I looked at the trajectory of, wow, I could be successful by everyone else's standards, but if I don't have myself, if I don't have who I am, 10 years, 5 years, 20 years from now, what kind of life is that, you know? And so allowing myself to feel the pain of that reality, for me, is what shook me up.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. One of the questions that I'm frequently asked is how I manage to produce so much content and do it this consistently. Here's the thing, it wasn't always like that. A lot of people find themselves distracted, overwhelmed, or procrastinating when it comes to things that are most important in their lives. Often they'll have an idea for a business, book, charity, work of art, or creative project, and they'll always talk about doing this thing, only somehow those ideas never materialize into something they can share with the world. And I can relate. For the majority of my life, I literally started dozens of things that I never finished. Hobbies, training regimens, online courses, books, and much more. Needless to say, not being able to follow through on something is a problem that I am intimately familiar with. My old roommate even used to make fun of me every time I started a new hobby. Well, as you know, over the last few years, that's changed quite a lot. I went from being all over the place to incredibly focused, creating more while reducing the amount of time I spent on my work, and I want to share that process with you. If you struggle with creative fatigue, overwhelm, procrastination, or just consistently following through on the things that matter to you, I really think that this is something that could help you. Over the last 10 years, we've conducted over 700 interviews with top performers, read hundreds of books, and learned from our own personal experience writing books, planning events, and much more. For the first time ever, we've distilled everything we've learned into an easy-to-follow, step-by-step system that shows you how to become the kind of person who can consistently follow through on the things that really matter. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/finish to learn more. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. So let's say that you have a project like a website that you've happened to finish. Well, HostGator is perfect for helping you to get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you want to get your hands dirty. And they make it easy and free to switch from an existing host. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off all of their hosting packages. Coot, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, I actually came across your story because your publicist wrote in and told me you had a book. I not only got a chance to read the book, but as we were talking about before I hit record here, I had actually seen your work very, very many years ago. So it was very cool to sort of, get exposed to it in this level of depth and really kind of understand your story. So I want to start with a question that I have found has always been very revealing and informative. And I think in your case, in particular, I think it will be very interesting to see how you answer the question. What did your parents do for a living, and how did that end up impacting the choices that you've ended up making with your life and your career?
What did my parents do for a living? Let's say my father was a miracle worker, a minister, a spiritual teacher, a spiritual leader. My mother was a part of his ministry. He's a healer. Mm-hmm. And so my father built, let's say, 300 churches in Ghana, West Africa. He had a huge church in London when I was growing up as a kid. Still does have a church in London, not as big as it was then. You know, like every Sunday in the mid-80s as a young kid, I remember having about 5,000-6,000 people attend his church on a Sunday. And he had probably two, three, I don't know, however many hundred thousands of followers in Ghana, still a large organization. So my first memories, literally as a young boy, I remember being around 5-6 years old and being a chubby kid lost in the crowd. And I'll never forget seeing this crippled woman crawling on the floor, and she literally couldn't walk, and she picks up the sand that this man walks on, being my father, and he wasn't aware. He was just walking. She wipes it on her face and stands up, and the crowd erupts. And so I grew up around miracles, and a lot of people might think, really, did that happen? You know, that's bullshit. You're just making this up. And I swear, you know, I saw this stuff day after day, week after week. And I remember I would go to school and I would tell people, because I thought everyone had this experience. You know, I thought this was just normal. And I'd go to school and tell my friends matter-of-factly, and they told the teachers, and the teachers thought I was losing my mind. And until the teacher came to my desk church and saw people having these experiences, my father would look at, let's say, a woman in a wheelchair on a Sunday at his church, and he would say, "Why are you in this wheelchair? Stand up." Or a person would come in with crutches. "Why do you have these crutches? Stand up. Do you believe?" And the person would say, "Yes, I do believe." "Then why do you have these crutches? Why are you in this wheelchair? Stand up." And this would go back and forth for about 10 minutes, 5 minutes, however long it would take, and they would stand up. So I grew up around these miracles. You know, age 8, I started speaking in my father's churches. He threw me. I grew up in this environment, I was more interested in soccer, to be honest. And so I would play soccer in the lobby of the church. And one day I got dragged to the front row and made to sit in the front row. And so one day my father asked me to speak and give the sermon, and threw me on stage. Yet no real preparation. I don't know what happened, but a sort of download came through this 8-year-old kid. And the crowd seemed to love it, and that you could say that's what started my speaking career at age 8. And so I became very, very obsessed. You know, so really, I would say how my father's, you know, background, and my mother being very involved, very spiritual as well. My father kind of grew up in a sort of metaphysical, spiritual, Christian-based but non-denominational philosophy. My mother was Buddhist. This very spiritual background, I think, set the tone for me to become really focused. And I was obsessed from a very young age, 8, 9, on the questions of, you know, why are we here, and who am I, and what's the purpose of life, and why do some people seem to have everything and seem to be miserable, and why do some people, even though they have nothing, in places like Ghana and India and some of the third world countries, why are some of these people who don't seem to have anything seem to be fulfilled and content and happy? And so this became an obsession. And I would go to school as a young boy. I hated school because I felt like school didn't really teach me much about living, about who I am, about life. I was learning geography and information, all this kind of stuff that I didn't feel would be any use to me. And so I would come home from school, do my homework, and literally get my homework done in a couple of hours, and probably from 8 to midnight every night from when I was as young as I can remember, I would devour self-help books, spiritual books. My first self-help book was by a woman called Shakti Gawain, and Creative Visualization, and kind of awaken to the power of, wow, we get to control our reality by the thoughts we think, and started reading everyone from the likes of Marianne Williamson and Wayne Dyer and Dennis Waitley, Brian Tracy, people like Jay Krishnamurti and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Ramana Maharishi, became from the Eastern traditions. And so this was my passion. I was literally so obsessed with, you know, with this sort of field of trying to understand myself. I'd be riding the train to school as a teenager, literally reading spiritual books on my way to school, reading, walking from the train station to school, listening to, you know, Tony Robbins power talk tapes, Jim Rohn, all your tapes on my way back from school. And so this was my passion, you know. So spirituality, self-help has been a real passion of mine, and I always knew I wanted to go into this field. And I didn't quite know how. When I was 14, my father announced to his congregation, quite unbeknownst to me, that I would be taking over his spiritual organization. And I guess I didn't really know any other way, so I went along with it. But I knew in my heart that something wasn't quite right. I knew in my heart that this wasn't my path. It just, you know, that feeling when something doesn't quite feel aligned. But I was too afraid to say anything to my father. And he announced to the congregation in front of 5,000 people, my son is taking over. And my heart sank because I felt the misalignment of what he was saying. And I was afraid that if I confronted my father, if I told him the truth, if I expressed my authentic self, that he wouldn't love me, that I'd be outcast, that I'd lose my relationship, that I'd be outcast from the community, that I didn't want to rock the boat because I'd be letting people down, I'd be alone, you could say, for the rest of my life. And so I didn't say anything and went along with it. And for 4 years, I think there was a inner turmoil that I faced, because I think when you know the truth, and I think many times we have a sense of our truth. Maybe the truth is, oh, I'm in a relationship and it's no longer right for me, or I'm married, it's no longer quite aligned, or I'm in a job that I hate and I'm compromising my integrity, but I'm afraid to leave because how will I survive? So I think many times we know a deeper sense of truth of what we feel, of what's required for our next step, but we're often afraid, and that fear is what stops us. And so for me, the fear stopped me from saying anything, and took me 4 years to muster up the courage. And every day I would think about it. Every day I would sit in my room reading these books of people like Wayne Dyer and Louise Hay, and something happened. I started reading people like Deepak Chopra and Tony Robbins as a 13, 14 year old. I remember seeing a new way. I thought, wow, here are some people with a positive message, and they're not teaching through an organizational structure of, let's say, a church or religion. And that opened my eyes. And then I read a man called Krishnamurti, Jay Krishnamurti. You may have heard of him. Mm-hmm. And I could really relate to Krishnamurti's life. He was being groomed to be the head of the Theosophy Society, and you could say an enlightened world teacher. And I could kind of relate to the expectations that he felt. And when he was 29, he left everything behind. And so when I read his book and some of his books, I just knew, you know, that feeling of, oh shit, the truth bomb has hit me. I just knew what I had to do. And when I was 17, mustered up the courage, I looked into my future and I literally saw I could take two paths. And I think life is a series of choices. Basically, I chose not to go to university, and which was, you know, not the most popular decision. I was probably out of a class of like 100 to 120, you could say, high school kids, I was maybe one of two that didn't. And it was just the expected thing, you know. It was a tough moment in my life to really own my truth and own my soul and own my knowing and literally go into the unknown without any guarantee. And I think we're constantly looking for a guarantee. The mind is always seeking to kind of for a sense of comfort, a guarantee, you know, a certain prediction into the future, and there is no guarantee. And so I decided to take the risk, and I had a conversation with my father, and I told my father one day, I'll never forget that day. For me, that was like going to my execution, you know. And I literally sat by my father's not the type of guy you have a conversation with, you know. It's like old school, his way or the highway. And I'd seen it happen before, where he just shut people down and kicked people out of his life because they didn't agree with him. So I figured the same was going to happen. But I made peace with that. I literally had to let go of my father, release my father, and own my path. And I had a conversation with him, told him I wasn't going to be taking over his churches. He simply said, are you sure? And I said, yes. He said, are you really sure? I said, yes. And that was it, you know. And cut a long story short, I ended up winning a green card in the lottery, and that's what brought me to the US. And you know, went and found teachers and mentors. And for me, that moment was so important because I was in this void, and I made this decision. I felt like I took this leap, and all of a sudden I'm just flying in midair. You know, I'd left the known, and now I'm flying in midair without any idea of where I'm going, just following this impulse in my soul. And what I found is, you know, sometimes what's required of us isn't always convenient. And so I was definitely being stretched outside of my comfort zone. And so one day I said a prayer to the universe, and that prayer was, universe, I feel this calling. I feel this impulse. I feel this vision. I feel this dream in my heart. Don't leave me hanging in midair, like, help. And literally someone hands me a magazine called The Economist, and I'd never read The Economist magazine before, but I felt this kind of chill in my being, like, there's a reason. I look in the back, it says the American government is giving away 55,000 green cards in the green card lottery. And that's when I knew that there was some greater intelligence than my own limited self. There was some intelligence of life, force of nature, call it God, consciousness, you know, infinite intelligence, whatever label you want to put on it. Something was unfolding my life that was bigger than me, that had a knowing. And when I read about this green card lottery thing, I just had this knowing of destiny. And so I applied, and I ended up winning, and came to America with two suitcases, and, you know, one in the country, about $1,000 in my pocket, one suitcase full of clothes, one suitcase full of, you know, inspirational spiritual books and tapes, and began my journey, and went and found teachers and authors and mentors, and traveled. And I mean I could go on and on, but that's kind of how I began. But I would say my parents, the foundation that my parents and what they did, you know, and I would say for me, what I observed with my parents, it wasn't so much like my dad didn't have a job. What he had was a mission. What he had was a calling, and his entire life was in service to something bigger than himself. And I think that has really impacted me, because even doing what I do now, which is traveling and speaking and training and, you know, inspiring people, it in some sense not that different from what my dad does, just a different form, a different structure for maybe a newer generation. I've always felt, for me, you know, what I do is not I didn't get into it for money. It's not about being famous. It was always about, how can I serve people, how can I serve humanity? And so I've always been very driven, in the same way as my parents, to be of service to humanity. And I've always felt a deep sense of purpose, and like, I can't not do what I do, you know. So I don't feel like I have a goal or I have a vision. It's more a sense of this feeling of, this vision has me, you know, this goal has me. And I feel like I've always felt over the years that I am a vessel and a vehicle for life to express through.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by DesignCrowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used DesignCrowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website, and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Wow. Okay. So many questions come from this. You know, the thing, one, I'm curious, do you remember what the content of the first sermon was when you gave, when you were 8 years old? And the other question is that, you know, that's a really sort of strange age to be exploring these deeper questions. You know, like, maybe kids do it and I don't realize it. And it makes me think about this, because I'm a surfer, and to me, surfing is very much a spiritual practice. But there's so many people who surf as kids, and I wonder if for them it's this sort of spiritual practice, or is this this, you know, really fun activity, because the idea that it's a spiritual practice is kind of beyond their comprehension at that age. So how did your answers to this question change over time, and what was the first first? How did they change with age? And what was the content of the first sermon?
The content of the first sermon, I had just read, believe it or not, Creative Visualization. This is pre-Secret, obviously, the secret book, which is Your Thoughts Create Your Reality, The Law of Attraction. And so Shakti Gawain wrote this book, you know, probably in the 80s, and it became quite popular. And so as a kid, I read this book like, wow, you can think thoughts and good things happen. And it was very simple, right? But for me, as an 8-year-old kid, it was revolutionary. And so I just read this book. And so my first sermon, what I kind of remember, but I don't really remember, because when I speak, it's happened literally ever since age 8, is I sort of dissolve and just something comes through me. It's like, I'm not going to say channeling, but it feels like I'm a vessel. But what I kind of remember is speaking to something about how your thoughts, you know, create your reality. Thoughts have energy, and so think positive thoughts. And it was kind of in that, and I was trying to fit that into the framework of where you place your attention is where energy flows. And so I remember, what I do remember is, given this analogy, there's a story in the Bible of Jesus when he had to feed the 5,000 people. And, you know, he's feeding the 5,000. He's speaking to a group of people, maybe 5,000, however many thousand people. And in the story, there's kind of a moment where obviously I'm paraphrasing, but there's a moment where his disciples say, "Yo, Jesus, people are a little hungry. They've been here for a few hours. We have to feed the people." And so the story I told was, you know, how Jesus didn't like freak out or get worried. There was a line in the Bible that I read, and that line went something like, Jesus turned his eyes to the hills. He turned his eyes upwards to the hills. And for me, I don't know, I just kind of, as a young kid, I kind of made an interpretation connected to Creative Visualization, the book, of what that meant for me was he didn't look at the problems. He didn't look at the current situation for a sense of faith or possibility. Turning his eyes to the hills, he transcended his current level of consciousness. He literally shifted his focus, which is what I remember saying. He shifted his focus to a higher level, and at that higher level, his focus was not on the limited resources, was on something else beyond himself. And that's that move, that inner focus, is what enabled him to be open to miracles. And so I was kind of sharing something like that from my best understanding, you know, as an 8-year-old kid at the time. And so so for me, I forget the second question.
Yeah, did your exploration and inquiry into these questions evolve with age? Because I think I'd imagine with age it changes quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, I think as a young boy, I was asking myself the questions of who am I and why am I here and what's the purpose of my life and what's the meaning of life. But you know, as I got older, they were actually some of the same questions. You know, just maybe my understanding, the nuances, the deepening of my understanding of those questions and the answers, you know, matured and deepened. But the questions I asked at age 8 and age 10, who am I, were the same questions I asked at 22 and 32. Who am I, and what am I, and where am I, and what is the nature of reality? And so the questions, what I found is, were simple questions, were eternal questions, questions that people have asked for many, 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 many years, you know? And so I would say my understanding and realizations of what I came to, the more I had certain experiences, were no longer just based on, like, as a kid, what I read from Krishnamurti or Maharishi Mahesh Yogi or another teacher or guru. But I started to have different experiences. Like when I went to India, I had different experiences. I remember being in India. You know, there was a moment where in my life, in my early 20s somewhere, where I was tired of reading. other people's experiences. I was tired of reading what Chopra was saying, what this person was saying, what that guru. I just wanted to have my own experience of, like, who am I really? Okay, that person says you are consciousness. What the hell is consciousness? You know, this person says you are not just the body, you are infinite. Well, what is that? I really wanted to know for myself. And so I literally packed everything, packed my bags, sold everything, broke up with my girlfriend, decided I was not going to come back to the West until I found certain answers, certain truths for myself beyond just reading and information. I wanted answers, not just ask the questions. And so I traveled. Traveled to northern Spain, walked the Camino 900 kilometers, traveled to Thailand, studied with monks, traveled to places like Bali and Japan and Israel, ended up in India, of course, like any good spiritual seeker ends up in India, and it is the Mecca. And so I ended up in India, and I started hanging with gurus and teachers and Siddha yogis and, you know, all sorts of yoga masters. And one day I literally found myself, I never forget, I found myself in Rishikesh, and every day I was probably living in Rishikesh for like a month, and every day I'd go jogging on the banks of the Ganges, and I literally, like, I wanted to be like a real amazing spiritual practitioner, so I'd go bathe in the Ganges, you know, which I would not advise to everyone listening, but I would go bathe in the Ganges, and I remember I'd hang out in this little cave where there were all these Bubbas, you know, and I felt like a true yogi, and one day, I went for my run, bathed in the Ganges, sat, meditated, overlooking the Ganges. And I had this, I don't know what to call it, but like I had this experience where I'll never forget, I was looking at the river, the Ganges River. The Ganges River flows from a very, from a source, you know, high up in the Himalayas, Gangotri, Gamukh. It flows from a little drop. A little drop flows then into a bigger sort of stream, and it flows from one source in one direction. And for me, that the symbology of, like, we all come from the same source, and we all are flowing in a similar direction. And so while I was sitting there, it was like having this multi-dimensional inner experience of feeling humanity, feeling us all, feeling life as this river, like we all one river. And I was looking at the river, and I saw all these waves undulating, and I felt like we are all these 7 billion, 6 billion, however many billion at the time, but we all, let's say now, 7.2 billion waves, part of the one ocean of life, the one tapestry of one consciousness that is flowing through and as us all. And I remember looking at this river thinking, wow, I'm one wave over here, and you're one wave over there, and, you know, Oprah's one wave over there, and this person, we're all one river, really. And where does one wave begin, and where does one wave end? And I saw these waves crashing into each other. It's like we're all like merging and interdependent, interconnected. There's no real separation. And it was literally like I just had this experience, and I looked up, and it was like all of everything physical, you know, the mountains and the people, everything was just like, it was a trip, man. It was like everything was just this energetic, super fluid, you know, motion like thing. And I felt like the energetic of all of life, and how there was no separation between me, you, anything and anyone. We're all just one river of humanity, just oneness being lived and breathed by the one consciousness. There's only one of us here. And I remember just feeling just this internal expansion of love, just such profound love, just like crying, you know. And so that experience was one of several experiences I had on that journey. It was no longer information for me of just reading, you know, like, who am I? It was like this deeper connected understanding that what I am is everything. What I am is nothing. What I am is you, that there is no separation between me, you, you know, Donald Trump, Oprah, the beggar on the street. We're all being lived, functioned, and breathed by the one life, the one river, the one consciousness. We are one stream of energy, different waves manifesting, but there's no separation. You know, I breathe out and all of my molecules, you breathe in, and it's just, you know, I eat food from a cow or a vegetable, and that becomes part of my body. And it's just, it was just this incredible like everything I'd been reading just came together in one moment. And I just, there was an awakening of love in that inherent realization for me, because I had it intellectually, but in that experience of oneness, there was a depth of love that opened up in feeling that there is no separation. And so for me, that really shifted everything, you know, and the question, and the answer, you could say, the question and the answer dissolved into one.
Wow. You know, there's another thing that really struck my attention that you mentioned, and there's this notion of you know, having the courage to own your path, you know, when you approached your father.
Yep.
And one of the things that it made me think is, okay, you know, all of us have this desire, I think, deep down to own our path. And how do you let go of the need for external validation at the same time you choose to own your path?
It's a tough one, right? It definitely is a tough one. How do you let go of the need of external validation? I would just say you let it go. What I'll share is, for me, when I looked at my path, when I looked at the expected path, because look, there's no shortage of people that will tell you who you should be and what you should live. And so I say, you cannot live an authentic life living someone else's life. You cannot live an authentic life being someone that you're not. And so when I looked at that path, the expected path, the path that everyone expected in terms of, you know, being normal, it was a death for me. You know, I felt the pain of that death, and the death of my own soul's betraying itself, and that really shook me up. You know, that really, really shook me up. And so when I looked at my future, when I looked at the trajectory of, wow, I could be successful by everyone else's standards, but if I don't have myself, if I don't have who I am, 10 years, 5 years, 20 years from now, what kind of life is that, you know? And so allowing myself to feel the pain of that reality, for me, is what shook me up. Like it was like looking 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30, like, no, if I kept going down, I'm going to say, an inauthentic path, down a wrong path, then I might build and create, but now I'm just going, you could say, faster in the wrong direction, and the pain of that was so, you know, I think what we sometimes do is, I think sometimes we know we're not living an authentic path, and we often feel that, but we try to distract ourselves, you know, we try to, well, something's a little off here. This relationship's not quite right, and but oh shit, if I really own my truth, what will happen? What I might have to break up. What's the consequences? And because we don't want to deal with those consequences, many times we don't allow ourselves to feel deeply. We don't allow ourselves to feel the pain. We don't allow ourselves to feel the truth. And so we distract ourselves. We work it away. We sex it away. We shop it away. We you know, sometimes we're living, I kind of give this analogy, we're living in a prison, you know, and rather than trying to get free of the prison, we kind of manipulate and create our lives to sort of get better prison food so we can feel more comfortable in the prison that we've built. And so there's a few questions that I've, you could say, refined and have asked myself that for me has helped me get free, break free, that might be valuable for those listening. I think deep down, we all know the truth. We all know the truth. Like if someone put a gun to your head right now, if you had a dilemma or a challenge or a relationship issue, like, I'm not sure what to do about this person, I don't know if this is right for me. If someone put a gun to your head or the person you love the most and said, tell me the truth about this situation, tell me what you know, within 10 seconds, you would likely say, here's the truth. And I think we're afraid to own that truth simply because of the consequences. So there's 4 questions I'm continually asking myself. Number one is, where am I lying to myself? What lies am I telling myself? What am I pretending to not know? It's kind of all one question. What am I pretending to not know? Because many times we pretend that we don't know. You know, we play this game of, I'm not so sure. I'm confused. I don't really know but deep down we do know. I always say there's a part of us deep down that knows everything, because at that deepest level of soul, of consciousness, that deeper intelligence, there is a part of us that knows everything, because at the deepest level we are everything. And I think it's just about having the courage to own that knowing. And what I found is to own that knowing is profound responsibility. To own that knowing is profound power. When we truly own our knowing, we can no longer say it's his fault or it's her fault. We can no longer be the victim. And so sometimes I think we're afraid of that power. So asking oneself, where am I lying to myself? What am I pretending to not know? The second question I'm constantly asking myself throughout the day too is what is this lie costing me? What is telling this lie? What is not living my authentic truth? What is it costing me? So if you are, let's say, living, you know, for external validation, if you're living to get someone's to like you and love you and for their validation, it's okay. But I just start by feeling, okay, what is it costing me? If you really feel the pain of what it's costing you, the lie, the untruth, the inauthenticity, living for someone else, just let yourself feel it. We're often afraid to let ourselves feel it, so we're numbing ourselves from truly feeling the pain, the cost, the consequences of the inauthenticity. And so I think when you really feel it, I say the truth burns. The truth burns. And it might be just saying to yourself, I hate my job. I'm done saying, well, it's okay, it's not bad, maybe I can. No, I hate my job. It is totally out of alignment with my integrity. But I'm afraid to leave it. I'm afraid to leave it because I don't know how I'm going to survive. So I'm going to stay doing this job that kills my soul. Something happens when you vocalize and you speak the truth without judgment, because sometimes we're judging. Well, I can't say that because it doesn't sound like what I should be saying. But if you just let yourself say the truth without judgment and be with the truth and hear the truth, it's like pulling back the curtain. There's no going back. It's like coming out. Then the truth burns. And even if you don't do anything about it, or even if you don't take specific action, let go of a relationship, let go of the person, leave your job, even if you don't do something about it in the moment, just feeling the truth and speaking the truth and feeling it consistently, it's like the truth burns. It's a fire that burns inside. And I like to say, then your head is in the tiger's mouth, and it's only a matter of time until something starts stirring and moving, till hopefully it's unbearable enough, until you either have too much pain, until you are suffering enough, until you realize, you know, this is not worth it. I listened to a very interesting quote one time from an interview with the Dalai Lama. You know, the Dalai Lama, Mr. Compassion, they asked him, what do you wish for the Western world? What do you wish for the West? And I thought he's going to say, being the Dalai Lama, love, peace, joy. He says, I wish the West more suffering. I thought, whoa, I wish the West more suffering. And what I realized in that moment was how compassionate that was, because sometimes, not all the time, you know, it's by feeling our pain, it's by feeling more suffering, then we get to a point finally where we say no more. No more living for anyone else. No more living someone else's life. No more living my life to try and get external validation and approval. And the truth ultimately is you can't please everyone. Look, there were people that didn't like Gandhi. There were people that didn't like Mother Teresa. I mean, how can you not like Mother Teresa? She's just the saint. But there were people that didn't like them. So there's always going to be people that don't like who you are. And what I found is, you know, people's opinions of you reveal more about themselves than it does about you. It's their reality. It's not necessarily the reality. And so once I realized that often people's opinions are a process of constantly projecting their opinions based on their own evolution, their own perception, their own path, their own level of consciousness, their own conditioning on me, that it has more to do with them than it does about me, that freed me up completely. And there was one great book that I'll never forget. It was called and I read this as a kid, and this really helped me in terms of that time as well, in terms of letting go of what people think about me and external validation, is it went something like, what other people think about you is none of your business. What other people think about you is none of your, it's really their stuff. And so the fourth question, I'll share this real quick, is in terms of like really getting in touch with the truth, one's authenticity, is really looking at, okay, by telling the truth, by being who I authentically am, what is it I'm afraid of? What is it I'm most afraid will happen? What's my fear? And I found that if you can face your worst case scenario, if you can just face it, like, I'm afraid my dad will never speak to me again. That was my fear. Like, we will never have a relationship. That's it. There came a point where I had to face it. I had to face it completely and make peace with it. When I made peace with my worst fear, something freed up. I was no longer run by it. I was no longer held hostage to it. I was no longer hijacked by it. And many times, the reality of the worst fear that you have, by being yourself, by being truthful, by living authentically, the reality is nowhere close to. The fear is nowhere close to the reality of what will actually happen. And so you find that the mind, as human beings, our mind being these creative things, the mind is always kind of strategizing and protecting and survival based. The mind is often creates this negative future fantasy about all the possible things that might not go wrong, might not happen, all the possible things, not based on reality, but just based on its own projection into the future. And many of those things we stress ourselves out about, that create paralysis in the moment, never happen. You know, maybe at least 90% of the things we freak ourselves out about never happen. And so so just facing the fear, making peace with the fear, then gives you the ability to, I think, it frees you up to take your power back. Okay, that person won't like me. Okay, let me actually make peace with that. That person will reject me. They won't like me. Feel that. Experience that. Like, just be with that fear. Cry if you need to. Experience it and make peace with that. When you make peace with that, I found there's a tremendous freedom, you know. And so I think that when you try to be who you think people want you to be, then you end up in a trap. And even when people love who you are pretending to be, deep down, you know, the friendship, the connection, the loving isn't truly real. There's a part of us that knows it's not real, because we know we're not being who we truly are. So I say, if you want to find out who your friends really are, if you want to find out who really loves you, not kind of loves you, not says that, if you want to find out who your authentic friends and relationships really are, it's very simple. Just be yourself. Yes, you will lose a ton of people. Yes, you will lose a whole bunch of so-called friends. But like those people weren't true friends in the first place. They were just in love with the illusion and the mask that you thought you needed to be in order to get love, validation, and approval. And so the last thing I'll say is, in terms of like feeling into the truth and living authentically, is just looking at and asking yourself, because sometimes you can get so focused on the fear, is what amazing thing might happen by being myself? What amazing thing might happen by speaking the truth, by telling the truth, by being who I am? And yes, you might lose a relationship, but you'll create space within yourself. You'll create space within your life to attract a whole new level of people, situations, and experiences that will be much more of a vibrational match and in alignment with your authentic self.
Just a quick reminder for those of you who are interested. If you struggle with creative fatigue, overwhelm, procrastination, or just consistently following through on the things that matter to you, I really think that this is something that could help you. Over the last 10 years, we've conducted over 700 interviews with top performers, read hundreds of books, and learned from our own personal experiences, writing books, planning events, and much more. And for the first time ever, we've distilled everything we've learned into an easy-to-follow, step-by-step system that shows you how to become the kind of person who can consistently follow through on the things that really matter. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/finish to learn more. You know, one of the really core ideas that struck me about the book was this notion of, you know, you being the one and nobody coming to your rescue, which really to me kind of was this notion that nothing external is going to be the source of your well-being or your happiness, which, you know, I think we all understand that intellectually. And yet we seek out all of these things, you know, whether it's accomplishment, whether it's success, whether it's love. And, you know, I'm curious, why is that, despite, you know, what we know about it? And it's funny because I've heard so many people in sort of a you know, spiritual teacher capacity say, you know, it's when you don't need these things that you get all of them. It's this very strange sort of paradox of letting go. When you let go, you get everything you want, but you can't let go in the hopes that you'll get everything you want.
I would say, you know, when you let go, you don't necessarily get everything you want. You know, I think that's an illusion, actually, that many times self-help teachers will pimp out to just become popular. And I don't think it's true. You may not get everything you want. The question becomes, who are you? Who is the you that wants that thing? And I think if we're not really in touch with who we are, then you might chase a whole bunch of things based on the illusion of who you think you are, and you might even achieve some of the things, the house, the car, the fame, the et cetera, what, just fill in the blank, the yacht, the watch, the whatever it is, only to realize, wait a second, is this all? Is this it? I got what I thought I wanted. I got, key question, underline, I got what I thought I wanted, what I thought was going to make me happy, what I thought was going to bring me security, what I thought was going to bring me love and value and a sense of self-worth, and I'm still miserable. Now, when that happens, you're really screwed in the best possible way. When that happens, that's when I think the real spiritual journey begins. When you got everything that you thought you wanted and you're still not happy, then you can go into depression, or it can force you deeper. And so I say, you might get everything you thought you wanted based on who you thought you were, but if you're not in touch with who you really are, your real self, then what you thought you wanted isn't going to be what you really wanted. It's just going to be what you thought you wanted based on who you thought you were, based on your conditioning. And so just the analogy I give is, and that's why I think many times just helping people, you know, get what you want, which is very appealing to the ego, get what you want, which is very appealing to you know, the egoic self. Oh, get what I want, be more famous, be more, you know, make more money. Wow. Yes. But I think there's an illusion there, because just helping people get more of what you want, I think, is very limited. So here's kind of, and let me backtrack. Here's an analogy I kind of give. When we're born as children, you look at a child. You look into a child's eyes. A child is, I mean, you look into a child's eyes. We're talking like when they're like really new, when they're, you know, in months. They're in touch with, there's a light coming from them. They're in touch with divinity. They're in touch with source, essence, just life. Something is magical. I think the most hardened criminal could look into a baby's eyes and melt, you know. Something beautiful about a child, and that child has an innocence. They remind us of ourselves, who we were, what we were. But what the hell happens? Before you know it, we end up 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years old. What happened? A child will jump on a table and sing and dance and love. It doesn't really care who you are so much. It's just full of life. The child doesn't care. Am I fat? What do you think of me? You know, I can't really sing like Bruno Mars or Celine Dion. It's just freely expressing itself. It cries. It shits. It's just like full free expression of life moving through this child, unrestricted. Well, what happens? A couple of things happens that I think will also tie into your question. So this child, so we're free, we're whole, we're complete, we're alive, you know, we're just fully expressed. Then we're born. And then over the course of months, we obviously meet our parents, and our parents are just doing the best that they can do based on their life, based on their pain, based on their hurt, based on their conditioning, right? That have been passed down from their programming, that's been passed down from generations, their parents, their grandparents, on and on and on and on and on. And before you know, they impose that on us. And now we're in an environment dealing with our parents who are doing the best that they can do. But also, you know, maybe we're in an environment of abuse, divorce, hurt, pain. Some of us have been through some very intense experiences. Some of us, you know, not so intense, but still, we all have stuff. Maybe our parents just weren't around. Maybe there was just emotional neglect, but they were very nice. Whatever it was, high or low, we all have certain experiences. So two things happen. As children, we slowly learn a sort of survival strategy to disconnect from the pain of our experience, our environment, not having certain needs met, not being enough, not being loved. You know, we're often not loved. We often don't feel loved totally unconditionally. So we start learning all sorts of strategies to disconnect from the pain of our environment, and we start shutting down parts of ourselves, parts of our feeling capacity, just to function, survive, and not get overwhelmed and deal with our experience. Then we go into life, parents, caretakers, school, and we start learning, who do I need to be in order to get love? Who do I need to be in order for my dad to love me? Maybe as children we were like really loud and freely expressed, and maybe your dad said, be quiet, shut up. Children need to be, you know, seen and not heard, or we were mocked, or we were just whatever it is, something occurred. And so we started to learn. We started to contort ourselves, and who do I need to be to get love, validation? For me, growing up, growing up in the church, growing up with the kind of father I had, growing up in this environment with all these expectations, I became the good boy, the nice boy, you know, the yes person, the polite one. So we start adapting and contorting ourselves and developing all sorts of personas and developing all sorts of masks and strategies to fit in, to be loved, to be liked, to be validated. And then that often gets reinforced. And so we keep doing it. We keep doing it. And we start developing all sorts of masks, you know, that we then hold very tightly onto, a way of avoiding pain, but also a way of getting love. And then we kind of hold very tightly onto that way of being. We contort ourselves, hold tightly onto that. And it becomes our identity. And the more it gets reinforced, it becomes our identity. And it becomes who we think, keyword, who we think that we are, not necessarily who we really are. And before you know it, we're locked into a sort of false persona of who we think we are, disconnected from our true selves, disconnected from our authentic selves. And inside of that, we, you know, maybe there's insecurity and there's pain and there's hurt and there's neglect and all this stuff. And so now this is who we think we are. Based on this identity, sadly, we end up going into the world, doing relationships, making choices. Obviously, the degree to which we are conditioned. Yeah, many times we don't realize that we're conditioned. We don't realize that we are programmed. We often say, people often say to me all the time, my clients say, cool, I have free will. Yeah, but the degree to which we're conditioned is also the degree to which we don't have the ability to choose freely. We're being run by our past conditioning and programming. I mean, Lord knows, if we were to look at our choices, if we were to take relationships as an example, I think we've all had, you know, many different kinds of relationships, but even romantic relationships. I mean, I look at some of the first relationships I had and I think to myself, whoa, was I really choosing? Did I really choose that? I can't believe I chose that, you know? And so I think many times we're not choosing. We are being run by our conditioning that we're not even aware of truly. And so based on that, then are the goals that we say we want really what we want? Many times the goals that we set, many times what we think we want, the life we think we want to create, who we think we want to be in relationship with, who we think we need to be, who we think we need to be with in love and relationship, what we think we're attracted to, who we think we're attracted to, isn't necessarily authentic. Many times there's a, you know, based on this being locked in this illusory, inauthentic self, we're being run by an impulse, certain needs that weren't met that we're trying to now meet in the world. Like, wow, I wasn't fully accepted and loved by my parents in some way. I wasn't fully accepted and loved growing up. And now I think, wow, if I can be famous, or I can be on television and get everyone to love me, or I can just be a certain way and then I can get what I didn't, then I can get fulfilled out here in the world, certain needs that weren't really fulfilled inside. And I said, and so when we can realize that and become conscious of that, then I think we can begin to become aware, take a step back, and find simple and authentic ways to truly uncondition ourselves by becoming aware, find ways to feel the pain of many of the things that we learn to suppress, and also find ways to truly, you know, it sounds cliche, but truly accept ourselves and love ourselves and meet those needs and heal those parts of ourselves that didn't get certain needs met that now we need to, that we now we think we need to meet in the world that will never be met in the world. And and so I think when we truly can start healing ourselves and loving ourselves, then we take our power back. Then we start gaining a sense of internal freedom within ourselves, where we no longer need, you know, it out there. We no longer need it. Then we start becoming whole and reconnecting with our true wholeness and internal power. Then I think we're that much more able to go into the world and love fully, go into the world and give our gifts, go into the world and share our purpose, because it's not so much about, well, what do you think about me? Do you love me? You know, it's just more about, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. From this place of acceptance, from this place of peace, this place of internal equilibrium, we're now free to give who we are. And I think being who you are is authentically being who you are is perhaps one of the greatest gifts you can give the world.
Mm, wow. You know, I'm curious, what differentiates people who are unable or who are able to, you know, undo their past conditioning and programming from those who aren't?
I would say different things. You know, I've worked with many, many sorts of people over the, I mean, I've worked with thousands of people over the last 15 years. There is one thing, it's going to sound very simple. There is one thing I've seen that makes a difference in terms of people transforming, and it is commitment. Sounds simple. It's commitment. Having worked with thousands of people, one-on-one, seminars, large, small groups, people don't change unless they want to. People don't transform unless they are truly, truly committed. Many times we say that we want to transform. Many times we say that we want to shift. And we kind of want to, but we're not radically committed to. Why? Because maybe we're comfortable, you know, we're comfortable, or we're, as I talked about, we're a little afraid of the consequences. If I change, if I really shift, that might mean the end of my relationship, or who will I be? Or if I really change my way of being, then the way I've gotten love from society and the world, that won't happen anymore. So there's often payoffs that we have for staying stuck. There's often payoffs that we have for staying for being who we've been our entire lives, because those ways of being have actually worked for us. I often say, look, underlying every behavior, even if it's not serving us, even if it limits us, many of the behaviors and ways of being that we often do now that limit us, they worked for us when we were 5. They worked for us when we were 10. They worked for us when we were 15 and 18. But often we reach a point at 25, 30, 40, 50 when those ways of being no longer work. They actually end up limiting us. But underlying every behavior is a positive intention. We learned at a very young age a certain way of being to try and get to avoid pain, to get love, to get certain needs met. So there's a positive intention there. And so I think it's important, if someone is stuck in some reason, it's so easy to beat ourselves up. Oh, what's wrong with me? Gosh, I read this book and I know I should do it. And the book says step one, step two, step three, but I'm still not changing. So I think it's important to really have compassion for oneself. To me, healing, true healing, is the application of love to ourselves. And so it's important in the process of transformation to hold yourself with compassion, to hold yourself with loving. And even if you say, I just can't hold myself with loving, then hold the fact that you can't hold yourself with loving. Even hold that with loving. You know, even be patient with your impatience. Be patient with that. Love yourself through that. Because for me, the real issue isn't the issue. The real issue is how you relate with yourself as you go through the issue. The real issue is not even can you change or can you not change, but how can you be with the process of your changing or not changing? And as you can love yourself through that, I think it creates a space that transformation can happen. And so look at, okay, if I'm not shifting, what are the payoffs that I have for staying stuck? What are the payoffs that I have for not transforming? You know, I make people sometimes just tell the truth, you know, like I'm big on the truth. So own, why do I not want to change? People say, Coop, but I do want to change. No, I understand you do want to change. But tell me, why do you not want to change? Tell me all the reasons why you absolutely would not want to shift. I kind of make that people do that exercise when they come to my events before we even start. Tell me all the reasons before we start this weekend. Tell me all the reasons before we start this 12-day retreat. Why you would not change? And I make people kind of like out themselves. And when they out themselves, they can see what their internal resistances are. And most of those internal resistances and blockages we have are for a good reason. And when you can recognize that, then you can work with that, then you can, you know, negotiate with those parts of yourselves and start developing a kind of inner cooperation. So what's really important is a commitment. And what I found is if you truly want to shift, if you truly are committed, the question I ask people is, what do you want more than anything else? What do you want more than anything else? If you're listening to this conversation and you're saying, I really would like to shift. I like to shift is not enough. There's lots of people that would like to lose weight and like to be different. What do you want more? This is a question I asked myself years ago. What do I want more than anything else? Anything else? Because if you want to shift and you want to transform more than anything else, shifts will happen. You'll begin to align your actions, your thoughts, and your thinking to be consistent with the intention that you have. It's like if I took your head and stuck it underwater, and I held your head underwater for, let's say, you know, a minute, you might be alive, but you probably would still be fighting for air. And I said, hey, would you like a chocolate? Would you like a chocolate cake? Would you like a Lamborghini? Would you like a private jet? Would you like to be on the Oprah show? I mean, 2 minutes, your head's underwater. You wouldn't care about any of those things. The only thing likely you'd be caring about, you know, is air. If I asked you, if your head was underwater, what would you want more than anything else? Air. And we would fight for that air with every ounce of energy and intention. Every cell in our body would fight for air. And so what I found is if you want to truly shift, if you want to truly transform, if you want to truly, you know, break through more than anything else, to me, this is the foundation of what separates people that shift and don't shift. But many times we don't want to. I'm in this relationship, you know, I'm not in love, but help me be happy. No. What do you want more than anything else? And so I would say start. How do you start? Start by telling the truth. Start by feeling the truth. You have to want the truth and want to be free more than you want what you have. You have to want the truth and want freedom more than your comfort, more than the relationship, more than your job. You have to, if you want that more than anything else, transformation must and will happen.
Okay, I have two final questions for you.
Awesome.
One of the things that I know you spent quite a bit of time talking about in the book was the notion of presence. And presence comes up over and over again. And it, you know, I was having a conversation with one of my friends yesterday about the importance of presence and how something was causing me a tremendous amount of anxiety. And she said, well, what do you like when you're not having that anxiety? I said, present. And she's like, well, there's your answer. But the question is, how do you balance presence with the desire for accomplishment of our goals, our dreams, et cetera?
Wow. You know, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah.
For me, you know, the old paradigm in terms of the accomplishment of goals, right, is we often ask ourselves the question, what do I want? And what do I want? And, you know, kind of we spoke in this interview about the whole, what do I want? And you might get everything you thought you wanted based on who you thought you were, but it's not really what you want. So obviously, I think when you really uncondition yourself, which is a process. It's not like a quick technique. It's a process. It's a life process. But the more you peel the layers away, I think the more you connect to your authentic nature, the more you connect to your authentic presence, the more you are able to simply be, the less you need to be defined by things outside of yourself. Now, sometimes that can be scary for the ego because we're like, oh shit, well, how am I going to accomplish anything? How am I going to be successful? How am I going to be, you know? It's like, but the more you, I think, transform and are not driven by egoic insecurity and competition and division and duality, the more you have a sense of peace inside, the more you actually connect with the true nature of your being that is presence. And I think from that place of peace, what I found is there's a tremendous freedom. You're not doing this thing to try and get something out there that you don't have. You're connected to it already. You're not trying to achieve that goal to try and get peace. You're not trying to achieve that goal to try and get a sense of validation or enoughness. You are that already. And so from that foundation, I think a tremendous freedom and power arises when you can move into life from already being. You can move into life from the alreadyness of your presence. And so for me, the question shifts then from, what do I want? What's my goal? What's my goal? What's my goal? What do I want to achieve? What are my 10 steps goals? What am I going to, I'm just going to go out and crush it in the world, to what is it that is seeking to express through me? And for me, a profound shift happened from trying to make my life happen and achieve these goals to then connecting with a deeper level of my authentic nature and presence. And then from that presence, feeling the revelation, feeling, okay, not from the ego, not from the persona, not from the mind, but the deeper desire, you could say, you know, it's language here, but of my soul, of my being, feeling the deeper desire. I would even say the deepest impulse of life. What is the deepest impulse of life that is seeking to express itself through me? Because the more you rest into presence, the more I feel you bring yourself in tune and in alignment with life, the intelligence, the pure intelligence of life itself. And I think when you rest in that place, then you can start just tuning into what is the deepest impulse that is seeking to express through me. What is the deepest impulse? And just remain open. And then I believe I found that your goals, your dreams, your desires, it doesn't mean you're going to sit there on the couch comatose. You know, you might work 20 hours a day. You might be in motion. But where the goals, the visions, the dreams arise from are a whole different place, a whole deeper place. And then the impulse of life starts moving through. Then that book that it comes through you, then that book, then you create the space within yourself to catch the vision for the creative reflection, the creative impulse of life to express through. And then they're not just your goals anymore. Then that's not just your dream anymore. It's life's dream. And you become the vessel. You become the vehicle. And when you realize, well, this isn't just my goal. This isn't just my, as an ego, separate self, my goal. This is life is seeking to express this through me. There is a tremendous peace, because when you're wrapped up in this is my goal and I as a ego, separate self, I have to make it happen. How do I make it happen? Oh my God. Then a whole bunch of stress, and then you're not present anymore. Then a whole bunch of stress and fear, and oh my God, and what will people think? And the shame, and oh, it doesn't. What if it doesn't work? But if you realize this is not, I'm not the doer here. Life is what is life. The same intelligence that birthed the sun, the star, the moons, the galaxies, the same intelligence that's breathing 7 billion people, the same intelligence that's functioning the fish in the sea and the whales and the lion in the Sahara, the same intelligence that's functioning all of existence is actually living and breathing me, and is the force that is seeking to express through me as this vision. then that this dream belongs to life, which has been around a hell of a lot longer than I have, and it will be around a lot longer even when me as this separate mind body is gone. Surely it knows how to fulfill itself if we can open ourselves and get ourselves out of the way. And I think for me, that's where the magic is. Then we can remain just present, present in this moment, and allow. What it requires, though, I think, is the next level. It requires that we get ourselves out the way. But if you look at all the great ones, right, the Gandhis of the world, the Mother Teresas, the Mandelas, I think they create miracles, the Jesuses of the world, all these folks, because they didn't just do it with their own limited egoic minds. They surrendered themselves. And I think for me, that's the key. We are here to surrender ourselves. And as we surrender ourselves, we allow life to move through. And that doesn't mean we won't be, that doesn't mean we won't do. It just, I think the shift will be, it might, so you look at someone, it might not look that different. It might look like, well, this person is working 20 hours a day and that person's working 20 hours a day. But when you're coming from that level of presence and you could say you are being used by life, where the energy and the motivation is arising from is a complete, you are being fueled by a different energy. One is acquisition, competition, what can I get, which is, there is no ultimate satisfaction there. And one, you are being used by life itself. And so I think that shift of what I've sought to do is really sit quietly and feel, be present and feel, what's the impulse? And then align my actions, my goals, my planning, my strategy, my team, my company around the deepest impulse, not the other way around.
Wow. This has been really, really thought-provoking and incredibly insightful. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable
Cool.
Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Wow. I love these questions. Let me sit with that a few seconds. Unmistakable. You know, I'm going to pick off where I continued in my last response. I think what really makes us unmistakable is, you know, the world is constantly trying to have us conform, you know, say be normal and just, why can't you just be normal? And so I think when we are, for me, when we are able to surrender, when we are able to let go, when we are able to get our small selves, our limited selves, conditioned self, ego self out of the way and allow life to live through us. You look at Michael Jackson. He wasn't just dancing of his own human self. He was being danced by life. That was unmistakable. Michael Jordan, he wasn't just, you know, he was gone. He would even say when he's in the zone, he's not there. That was unmistakable. Because there's no limit to that. You know, you look at the great ones who were in the zone of the moment. And so for me, the degree with which you can get yourself, your small self, out of the way and surrender yourself to being lived by life itself, then you tap into a whole nother level of possibility and power and creativity that is life, that is the zone of miracles, that is beyond your mind. You look at Mother Teresa, Gandhi, you look at Mandela. They were truly unmistakable because I believe they were being lived by the total force of life and nature itself. And what life was able to do through them was way beyond anything they could have done of their own limited selves. They were unmistakable. So I would say, trust bigger than yourself. Surrender. See what happens. Be lived by life. Miracles will happen. Miracles will unfold.
Well, I think that makes a very fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you, your work, and the book?
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Well, I just have to say it's been really beautiful hanging with you. You know, I do a lot of interviews, and I think there's a space that you hold, my brother, that is really – there's a presence in the space that you hold – during your interviews that I feel really allows, at least for me, the beauty of my soul, and I'm sure other guests to really emerge. So it's been just sincerely a real blessing, a lot of fun, and a joy to hang with you. Yeah. In terms of if anyone feels inspired by this conversation, I love connecting with people from all over the world. So if you feel inspired, there's a couple of websites. Number one, my main website, CoopBlackson.com, www.CoopBlackson.com. If you feel maybe you might want to explore something deeper, and I created an amazing event for leaders and visionaries to break through to the next level. It's called www.BoundlessBlissBali.com, BoundlessBlissBali.com. In terms of the book, it's called You Are the One. You can go to Amazon, or you can go to www.youaretheonebook.com, where you'll also receive free gifts. I'm also on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, and social media. Just reach out, say hi, let me know you heard me on the Unmistakable podcast.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.